The following program is recorded content created by the Truth Network.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, biblical scholar and cultural commentator, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice for moral sanity and spiritual clarity. Call 866-34-TRUTH to get on The Line of Fire. And now, here's your host, Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey friends, welcome to The Line of Fire for this very special broadcast. Rabbi Pesach Palicki, Orthodox rabbi, born in America, living in Israel with his family now, and on the front lines, literally, of what is happening in the land. He reached out to me about doing this broadcast. He has been involved for years in Jewish-Christian relationships. He's spoken in many churches about Israel. And I'm so thrilled that he's taking time in the midst of a crazy, busy, difficult schedule to join us. Friends, if you're watching on YouTube, click share immediately. Click thumbs up. You're watching on Facebook, click share on that. Listening on radio podcast, share this with a friend immediately. This is going to be a very important broadcast. Rabbi Palicki, thanks so much for joining us from Israel right now.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's just wonderful to be with you again at this time. It's a very difficult time, as you said, very tense. And I have to just tell you, as an opening statement, that I'm 53 years old, and I have never in my life felt such existential pain for what our nation is going through.
Yeah. So Pesach, how long have you lived in Israel now?
I've lived in Israel just about 30 years. It'll be 30 years. I'm 29 and a half years in.
Extraordinary. Yeah. And how old are your kids?
My oldest is 26. My youngest is 15.
15. And so right now you have children that are in the IDF in the midst of the battle. Is that correct?
Sure, yeah. I'll go in order of age of who's in. My son-in-law, so I'm going to count him as one of my kids. My son-in-law is married to my daughter. My daughter is pregnant with our first grandchild. Was expected around Purim time, about 5 months from now, 6 months from now. And he's a commander in the Nachal Brigade, an infantry unit. And then I have a son who's 25 years old, and he's a reservist, also in combat infantry. I have a daughter who's 24. Yes, my kids are close in age. I have eight of them. Mm-hmm. My daughter who's 24 is a combat medic, so she's working at a kind of field medical unit that also does search and rescue operations. That's also down near the front. And my youngest, who's in, is 19 years old. He's not a reservist, and he's not an officer. He's an enlisted soldier in the Givati Brigade in an infantry unit, and he's been right in there. We talk about I can't go into too many details, but when you've seen on the news about how in the early days the soldiers were securing the Israeli towns in the south. Let's just say we've been praying for my son a lot.
Yeah, understandably. And again, thank you for wanting to be on the air to speak to all of our listeners and viewers in the midst of such extraordinarily chaotic times. We want to talk about, from your perspective as an Orthodox Jew, the spiritual, biblical significance of what's happening. We want to talk about the geopolitical realities from your perspective. But first, just take us back. It's Shabbat, so you're not using electronic communication. You're not on your cell phones or things like that. How did you first begin to hear the news a week and a half ago, and then what happened? What kind of effect did it have as the news began to circulate in your community?
It was not only Shabbat. It was also a festival known as Shmini Atzeret. In the Bible, it doesn't really have a name. It's just called the Eighth Day. It's the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles of Sukkot. And more traditionally, over the last millennia or so, it became known as Simchat Torah, the Festival mm-hmm. of the Torah. It's the day. It's really one of the most joyous days on the Jewish calendar. So it was the end of the festival, which happened to fall out on a Shabbat this year. So for multiple reasons that we were all unplugged. Everyone in my community, where I live in an Orthodox Jewish community here in Beit Shemesh in Israel, and as you said, we're not aware of what's going on in the news. But in our community, there's always a few people, there's always a kind of cell that, for security reasons, in every community, no matter how Orthodox, who are plugged in, who are receiving updates if anything happens, who are there for security reasons. So there's always someone who knows what's going on. And I was actually in the synagogue at the time. I like to pray early, you know, just like in the Christian community, there's often, you know, churches will have various services at different times for the early risers and the late risers. And I'm an early riser, so it was probably about 7:30 in the morning, and we were in the synagogue. And it was late in the service. It was right after the Torah reading, which happens in the center of the service, in the middle of the service. And the gabbai, I guess in English it's called a sexton, he's sort of the person in the synagogue who keeps things running, mm-hmm. Came up and he said, "I have an announcement."
He said, "I have an announcement to make. There have been air raid sirens in other parts of the country, including Tel Aviv. And in many places in the country." He didn't tell us any other details, and therefore there's an expectation that we may also have air raid sirens in Beit Shemesh. And if there's an air raid siren, everyone make sure to get down on the floor, put your hands on the head, because we were in the basement of the synagogue. Oh, I should say that also. He had told us beforehand to move down to the basement of the synagogue. We had moved down. The basement of the synagogue is reinforced like a bomb shelter. But to take extra precautions, he said, if there's an air raid siren, we should all get on the ground. And I have to say, the first reaction was, oh my gosh, we're under attack, even Tel Aviv. That doesn't happen so often, although it's happened a few times. In the last few skirmishes, those who follow Israeli politics in the last 15, 20 years, we know that every few years or so, there's a kind of flare-up out of Gaza, where the rockets which they lob at Israeli settlements, which they're always lobbing at Israeli settlements to greater or lesser degrees, but every now and then things intensify, and then there's a what we might call a mini war or an operation where Israel intensifies its bombing. A few of these operations have included small ground campaigns. We slap down Hamas a little bit, and then things are quiet for a few years, and that's the way it's gone. So honestly, I thought that that's what we were involved in, another one of those. It was like, oh my gosh, maybe this is another one of those flare-ups. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know the full extent of it. And sure enough, in the middle of the service, an air raid siren went off. Now that's where things really got serious for me, because air raid sirens almost never go off in Beit Shemesh. Where we happen to be located, we're not where they generally aim. So even during this entire war, we've only had half a dozen or so air raid sirens, which might sound like a lot to people to have rockets being shot at your town half a dozen times in a week, or a week and a half at this point. But compared to the rest of Israel, we didn't have that many air raid sirens. But that day, when the air raid sirens went off, we hit the floor, and it was right. I have to tell you, it was at the point in the service. I was leading the service at this point. It was Musaf, which is the end part of the service, and I was leading the service. And it was just as the Kohanim are the priests in the community. In every Jewish community, there are people mixed into the population who we know through direct line of tradition. You know, the Jewish people are an unbroken chain. And there are people who are from the lineage of Aaron the high priest, of the priestly families of the temple, and we know who they are. And those people have certain things that they can do that others can't do, things that others can do and they can't do. They have separate rules, as you see in the Bible. And one of the things that they do in the prayer service, at a certain point in the service, they walk up to the front, they ascend, and they raise their hands and they recite the priestly blessing. The priestly blessing that you find in the book of Numbers, chapter 6, verses 24 to 26. Mm-hmm. And it was just at that point in the service where they were ascending to recite the priestly blessing. And they had just put out their hands, and I was about to say, as the leader, we prompt them word by word. That's how the priestly blessing is recited. And I was about to recite the first words of the priestly blessing, and that's when the air raid siren went off. And we all hit the ground. We got up. Another air raid siren went off immediately. We hit the ground again. And then by the time we got up and resumed, we were all shaken. And the opening words of the priestly blessing are Yivarechacha Adonai V'yishmerecha, which means God bless you. And everyone translates it as keep you. But the word keep in English has other connotations, like, you know, keeping possession of something. But the word Yishmerecha means he will protect you.
Mm-hmm.
He will guard you. And it was like, these are words that I've been hearing every day. I say them as part of my daily prayers every day, the priestly blessing. I never thought about them so much. May the Lord bless you and protect you. So we went home. We went home after the service. Everyone kind of rushed out. We knew something was up, but we didn't know exactly what. Now, my son-in-law, who's an officer, he had received a message that he had to go. So he left. He got in his car on Shabbat, which is, as you know, highly unusual, and he drove off. My 19-year-old, who's, as I mentioned, currently serving, had been released for the last day of the festival. He had missed the other days of the festival he had been in, but they had let him out for a short leave just to come home for the festival day. And he had received a message that he had to go back. And for the first time in my life, I drove my car on the Sabbath, on Shabbat. I got in my car, drove my son to the pickup spot where there were other people in their festive clothes, other parents dropping off their children in uniform to go into battle. So that was the last day of the festival. That's what it was not what I had hoped. Let's just say that. After the festival ended, my two reservists, who I mentioned, my older kids, my son and daughter, also both got their calls. They both went in. So by the time this was a day old, I had three of my children plus my son-in-law, so four of my kids who were on their way down to a war zone.
Extraordinary. We've just got a minute and a half before the break, and maybe we can ask the question, as people who believe in the God of Israel and think of Psalm 121, Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shema Yisrael, the one who protects Israel with neither slumber nor sleep, how we deal with that at a time like this. But when we come back, we want to get into this subject from the perspective of an Orthodox rabbi living in Israel, his own perspective and perhaps that of some of the community that he's in. Is there a larger spiritual significance to this? Is there something that ties into Scripture about this? You know that we don't set dates here on the Line of Fire, and I'm always dismissing those that get sensationalistic. Nonetheless, there are times that are times of massive upheaval. No, the Holocaust was not the end of the world, but a time of massive upheaval in the Jewish world and part of massive upheaval in the entire world. So we come back speaking with Orthodox Jewish rabbi living in Israel, Pesach Berlicki. And you can realize how family after family after family, this is the reality. They're kids right now on the front lines fighting terrorists who want nothing other than to destroy Israel and the Jewish people. The prayers of every Christian listening and watching are highly valued right now.
This is Michael Ellison, founder of Trivita Wellness. I want to introduce our Trivita Alfred Libby original patented sublingual B12, B6, and folate formula. I had the wonderful opportunity of meeting Alfred Libby, a pioneer in vitamin research. I also had the opportunity to obtain the patented formula, and the rest is history, with over 50 million tablets being taken by our Trivita members through the years. The amazing testimonies of mental clarity, mood enhancement, and more energy have been thrilling to me as a founder of Trivita Wellness. Not only is it an amazing B12 product, but it is loaded with the essential B6 vitamin. I call it the workhorse vitamin. It is vital for strong immune function and every body system. Here's what the National Center for Biotechnology Information says, and I quote, "It plays a key role and is crucial to immune function. It is a molecule necessary for the proper functioning of the entire body system and its role cannot be overestimated. Harvard Medical School of Health says folate is the natural form of vitamin B9, and it plays a key role in breaking down homocysteine, an amino acid that can exert harmful effects on the body when it is present in high amounts. I encourage you today to try the Trivita Libby B12, B6, and folate formula.
To order Alfred Libby's B12 for yourself, call 1-800-771-5584 or online at trivita.com. Order today and use promo code BROWN25 to receive 25% off your order. As a new customer, 100% of your order proceeds from your first order will go to support the Line of Fire radio broadcast. 1-800-771-5584 or online at trivita.com.
The Truth Network
presents Life 101, the basic rules for getting by and moving ahead in life.
There are thousands of financial books out there, yet overall our personal finances are in pretty bad shape. That proves one thing: the latest advice and the latest book on the newest financial twist is not really working. All the really good advice is really nothing new at all. In fact, some of the best financial advice goes back thousands of years. There's a simple but dramatic piece of advice in Proverbs 6 in the Bible. It says, "Go to the ant and consider its ways and be wise. It stores its provisions in the summer and gathers its food for the harvest." Now that is financial advice from the Bible that can turn your life around. Our consumer-driven society obsesses about ways to spend money, but the Bible says, like the ant, we should instead focus on ways to save money. A lesson we can learn from the ants. The point is, we don't need more financial advice. We simply need to apply the old-fashioned advice that's been around for years, or even millenniums. An aggressive, radical savings plan can utterly transform your family's finances. You are listening to the Truth Network. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get on the Line of Fire by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. Michael Brown here on this urgent update from an Orthodox Jewish rabbi in Israel, Pesach Balicki, who's become a friend. Pesach, from your perspective, what is the spiritual significance of this attack on Simchat Torah, what was meant to be the most joyous day of the year in the traditional Jewish calendar, now is going to be remembered also for this day of mourning and pain? Give us a spiritual perspective from your viewpoint.
We also can't ignore the fact that this attack took place almost 50 years to the day after the Yom Kippur War.
Yeah.
Which is, and between the Yom Kippur War and this attack, there has never been such a sense of existential threat on Israel. Not that Hamas is an existential threat on its own militarily, but because of their connection with Hezbollah. But from a spiritual perspective, my mind immediately goes to Amalek. When the people of Israel, when the children of Israel left Egypt, God had just decimated the superpower of Egypt with 10 plagues. He then drowned the entire Egyptian army at the bottom of the Red Sea. And that's when Amalek chose to attack. Now, you have to ask yourself, were they out of their minds?
Mm.
They just saw what God did to the Egyptians. They just saw what God did to the Egyptian army, splitting the sea, the 10 plagues. They're right nearby. They lived in, the Bible tells us they live in Eretz HaNegev, which means they live in the southern part. They live in what would be northern Sinai and southern part of Israel. So they're not far from Egypt. They knew what happened. They knew where Israel was. Why on earth would they attack them? Did they think that they would beat this nation after what God did to the Egyptians? And the answer is, that's not their goal. Their goal is to kill as many Jews as possible and to stand in the way of the nation of Israel inheriting the promised land. That's their goal. And that was the goal of the others who stood in the way of the people of Israel as they were trying to enter the promised land. And the battle that we're fighting today, you know, all the geopolitical analysis aside, and the geopolitical analysis is important. There are lives on the line depending on how those geopolitical questions get answered. But as people of faith, we have to keep things in proper perspective. This is the same war. The same war that we're fighting today is the war that we were fighting then. It's the war against an evil force that wants to kill as many Jews as possible and prevent us from entering the promised land. But there's something else important here, Michael, about the spiritual battle, which is we see everyone who looks out, and all your listeners, I'm sure, when you look out into the media, you look out into what's going on, you see this alliance between secular progressive leftists, the same people who are going to, you know, who are trans activists, who deny God, who are avowed atheists, are supporting and cheering for and in league with Islamic fundamentalists. And it doesn't seem to make any sense.
Nope.
I mean, we don't like either of them and they hate us, but they seem to have nothing in common. Until we notice what they do have in common. And what they have in common is that they both despise the Bible. And they both, let's be more precise. Because both of them deny the truth of our scripture, there can be nothing more anathema to them than the fulfillment of prophecies in our scripture. They can't have the Bible be proven to be true. If the Bible is proven to be true, they have to face a lot of other truths as well. And the nation of Israel's only definition and only real purpose and right to exist, who we are as a people, has to do with the Bible. And it has to do, and that's why we're in the land of Israel. Honestly, if the Bible is false, then we don't have a right to be in the land of Israel. Why should we? So if you think it through, these enemies of ours, who again, they hate us for different reasons, but they're both terrified of the possibility that our Bible will turn out to be true, and the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who made all those insane promises in the Bible, you know, because it's the reality we live in, it's easy to forget what a miracle it is. But in the ancient world, many, many nations went into exile.
Yep.
Tons of them. And that's why all those biblical nations you read about, you don't know anyone. I don't know any Moabites or Philistines, right? They don't exist anymore. The reason all these ancient nations don't exist is not because they all died out. It's because they were conquered by bigger empires. They were exiled. And within a few generations, new identities were formed. And those old identities, those old national identities were gone. To go into exile in the ancient world meant the end of your national identity. That's what it meant. So to predict, as all the prophets did, not just Moses in Deuteronomy 30, but all of them did, to predict that a people, a tiny people, Moses told us that we're going to be the smallest people, to predict that we're going to go into exile for many, many generations and then come back and reconstitute ourselves as a people to take possession of the land and become more numerous and more prosperous than ever before. The miracle of the return of the people of Israel to the land of Israel is like water running uphill. The only reason that we're not all falling on our faces and screaming, "This is my God," like the Jews who saw the sea split, is because it's political reality that we live in. And the last, as the Talmud says, "En bal hanes makir b'niso," the last person to recognize a miracle is happening is a person living through it. But this miracle of the people of Israel in the land, this fulfillment of prophecy, they can't stand it. They can't accept it. And I think that's what we're really fighting for. I think this battle is a battle not just for me and my family and for the people of Israel as an ally of America or as a democracy in the Middle East. This is a battle for God. It's a battle for the truth of His word. That's what I think the spiritual foundations of this are.
Yeah, so it's not even a conscious thing in people's minds. You know, for example, someone that would identify as a queer activist that hasn't read the Bible, doesn't know about biblical prophecy, you say, why on earth would they be standing with Hamas if they tried a gay pride event in Gaza? That'd be the last thing they ever did. Or some radical feminist siding with Hamas. Why in the world? Well, it's because there's a spiritual union. There's something else going on. It's like what we would encounter when friends of ours were in front of pro-life, in front of Planned Parenthood clinics saying, hey, there's another way, consider this. And they'd be confronted with atheists, with gay and lesbian activists, with Satanists. Think, what? And these would be the ones protesting against us. You said it's an unholy union against life. So back to you. We've got two more minutes, but anything else you want to say on that theme before we move on?
Yes. I think there are a few scriptures that people need to look to gain some clarity on what's going on here. First and foremost, I'll call on all of your listeners to read Psalm 83.
Mm-hmm.
Read it carefully. Psalm 83, which is not you wouldn't expect it to be read.
Hey, friends, Dr. Michael Brown here. Do you remember when people thought I was crazy when I said it's not too late for America, that God can still do something in our country, that there is going to be a pushback, a gospel-based moral and cultural revolution? And do you remember when people thought that you were crazy because you felt the same way? Because you believe what I was saying and already felt it in your heart? Well, friends, that pushback is here. The gospel-based moral and cultural revolution we've been talking about for 25 years is unfolding, and we are right in the thick of it. And the Line of Fire broadcast is divinely positioned for such a time as this. Friends, you would be so gratified and blessed as I hear, if you could hear what I hear, testimony after testimony as leaders, young people, old people, moms, dads, students, people from all backgrounds come up to me and say, Dr. Brown, you're providing a template for us. You're providing a blueprint for us. You're showing us how to do this, how to have hearts of compassion, backbones of steel. But friends, it's a joint effort. We do this together, and with your support, we can amplify this broadcast around the nation and amplify this voice to shake the nation. Join our support team today. Become a torchbearer with a dollar or more per day. Here's the number to call to sign up, 800-538-5275. That's 800-538-5275, or go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. And become a monthly supporter. Click on Donate Monthly Support. I want to immediately give you two classic books, Compassionate Father or Consuming Fire, Who is the God of the Old Testament, and Revolution, which will really show you what it means to be a Jesus follower today. Plus, you get free access to our online classes and so much more. Sign up today. AskDrBrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get on The Line of Fire by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to a thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast, a very, very sober time. Getting an urgent update from a friend, Orthodox Rabbi Pesach Walicki, has worked for years in Jewish-Christian reconciliation, understanding, spoken in many churches. I think listening to him, you can appreciate the insights that he is bringing. Rabbi Walicki, there's a midrash as there's celebration and singing as the in Exodus 15 after the Pharaoh and his armies drown in the sea, that God brings to attention to the angels that the Egyptians that were killed, that were swallowed up, were human beings also. We know that scripture often talks about God's compassion over all of his works. We know that he calls for care for the widow, for the orphan, and things like that. He even excoriates foreign nations that say would would commit acts of cruelty one towards another. Beginning of Amos, you know, you ripped open pregnant women, you're going to be judged because of that. These are not Jewish people, but foreign nations are going to judge. And yet you have in the Bible God calling for the extermination of the Canaanites, the way people would put it. We see what Hamas did, the horrific evil. And people say, well, didn't God command the Israelites to do the same thing to the Canaanites and the Amalekites? What is the traditional response to that? And what is God's heart for the suffering of the people in Gaza right now as they're in the midst of this hellish war?
Wow, that's a complex question. It's a great question. And it's a question that needs to be asked about the Bible. When you're reading the Bible and you see these commands about the Canaanites, about the Amalekites, about wiping out every man, woman, and child, I think we make a big mistake if we read the Bible and expect every aspect of the Bible to apply equally in all times. And when I say, and I'm choosing my words carefully, I didn't say to apply in all times. I say to apply equally in all times. Because God did, we can get pretty far afield here theologically, but, you know, you could ask a similar question, even though it doesn't touch the same emotional places. But when you look at things like death penalties for things like lighting a fire on the Sabbath, I mean, what would you think if someone lit up a cigarette on the Sabbath and the news headline the next day was that we stoned him in the public square in Jerusalem? What would that do for the glory of God in the world, right? And yeah. yet it's there on the books. So this is a complex question about how we evaluate the morality of the Bible, especially the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, especially when we look at that, considering the context in which it was, when we evaluate the morality of certain things there. So I'll just answer the Sabbath one as an analog for this whole issue, because it's very hard to discuss such a broad theological issue in such a short time.
Of course, of course.
But for example, imagine you live in a world which most of the world lived in for much of human history, where if you publicly insulted the king, you would get killed. Right? In most countries in the world, if you go back 1,000, 2,000 years ago, if you publicly insulted the king, you'd have your head chopped off.
Yep.
Almost anywhere in the world. And not only that, if you lived at that time, because we make a mistake of thinking that we'd have our modern moral sensitivities, if you lived at that time and someone insulted the king and got their head cut off, you'd be like, well, of course. Now imagine if you live in a society where it's totally acceptable to kill someone for insulting the king, but if you insult God, nothing happens to you.
Mm.
So we have to understand that although the Bible is for all times, God did something very, very complicated here. God wanted to give us a single text that would work for all times, but he also knew, and part of his plan was that our ethics and morality would change over time. So how do you solve that? How do you have an eternal document that's going to apply in all times and all places to all humanity when what humanity needs as instruction is going to shift and change throughout time? And Michael, you could probably already see that I'm dipping my toe in the water of some Jewish Christian issues here also. But the point being that we cannot look at those things and say, aha. What I would say, and this is the argument on the Orthodox side. I know what the Christian response to this is, but on the Orthodox Jewish side, the response is yes. With the way we understand the laws in the Bible, some of them are somewhat contextual, and the rabbis stepped in and used the rabbinic authority. Which is, again, a big topic I'm opening up here. They use the rabbinic authority to make modifications so that the application of what the Torah is meant to be is suitable for a time period. So the most notably, when it comes to the death penalty, it was declared by Rabbi Akiva during the first century proudly that we don't do this anymore. We don't kill people anymore. It's, it, and, and that and that the Sanhedrin just pretty much doesn't do it.
Right.
So that's it.
Yeah,
again,
and just
this
to,
is a big topic.
I just wanted to address it. In fact, friends, tomorrow, if everything goes as planned, I'm going to dive into this and really look at this head on as far as why did God command the slaughter of the Canaanites? Did it actually happen with killing of men, women, and children? How is that any different than what Hamas or ISIS have done? So make sure you tune in and hear this. But I think it's, and then, you know, as you said, Christians would say, well, then Jesus taught, yeah, this was for then. I'm telling you this. So in every case, we recognize that there were things that were important at a certain season and that God's standards remain the same, but application can change over the years. But while I have you on the air, and then we're going to, I'm going to give you free rein to give your perspective, geopolitical perspective of what's happening, America, Israel, etc. But we spent time together. You're a rabbinic scholar. You've led yeshivas. We spent time interacting. I saw the level of your scholarship as I asked you certain questions, etc. So I constantly hear one of the libels against the Talmud and Orthodox Judaism. Well, the Talmud Orthodox Jews just think that all Gentiles are cattle and they should just be destroyed. And that's Israel's attitude towards the Palestinians. Would you just take a moment and set the record straight on that before we go to the geopolitical implications of what's happening today?
Okay. So I'll start by saying that if we want to play tit for tat about who's ancient writings have worse things to say about the other between Jewish and Christian writings, you know, I'm not sure who would win or who would lose, but I find this to be the same thing as when Jews will, you know, look into some of the writings of church fathers that say horrible things about the Jewish people.
Yes, sir.
Now, you know, and you know, I don't have to teach you about those. You're probably the expert on those things. But there's a lot and yet Christians today, even Christians who drink in thirstily the words of St. Augustine, the vile things that he said about the Jews, they would disavow. So once again, we have to contextualize. The Jews living in the time of the Talmud, who were writing the Talmud, if you think about where they were living, they weren't living among Christians, 20th century Christians. Where they were living and the type of lifestyle they were living in Babylonia and Persia and the places where the Talmud was being worked on, and the type of lifestyle that they saw there and the way they were treated by those people, yes, there was a view that this is a way of life that we must utterly disavow and utterly discourage our children from ever even considering as a possibility. It was a morally and ethically corrupt society in comparison to Jewish life at the time. So that's where those statements are coming from. There's no, I would point anyone who's skeptical of what I'm saying, just look at Jewish history and tell me, when do you see Jews ever acting on, you know, on such statements? Do you see Jews ever oppressing or wholesale massacring or attacking people of other faiths? Yes, there are lines in the Talmud that say these things. We have to keep them in we have to keep them in historical context. And of course you'll always have extremists on our side who look at those and say, no, that's applying to everybody. But then someone will dig them up and share it on Twitter and paint all Jews that way.
Yeah.
But I would just say, look at the Jewish people and look at the record and show me where are the atrocities? Where is the, you know, where's the bigotry? Where's the racism coming from us? I know you found the line in the Talmud, but show it to me and the people of Israel themselves.
Yeah. And friends, Rabbi Walicki wrote a tremendous article that he sent to me when there were some religious Jews who spat on Christians during Sukkot, during the celebration of Tabernacles in Jerusalem. It caused an outrage in Israel. And Rabbi Walicki wrote a very powerful piece rebuking this. And the thing is, it's so aberrant. And then Pesach, what boggles my mind, and I'll give you 2 minutes to respond, then we get to geopolitical issues. What boggles my mind is that people will somehow compare a few extremists spitting towards Christians, compare that to Hamas slaughtering children and babies and women. It's mind-boggling, but that's the moral insanity in which we live today.
You know, that's actually a good segue into the geopolitical, because one of the most important distinctions we have to make is what place do people hold in a community? This goes for anti-Semitism too. You know, like with anti-Semitism, is the goal to completely eradicate anti-Semitism from the face of the earth? Well, I guess in some sort of idealistic way, but that's not realistic, right? The goal is to marginalize it to the point that it has no power and no real world impact. You know, here's what I mean. If anti-Semitism a century ago was that Jews in America was that Jews couldn't live in certain neighborhoods and there were quotas on how many Jews could be accepted to certain universities. And today anti-Semitism, I'm not saying it is, but let's say we get to a point where today anti-Semitism is punk kids spray painting swastikas on the side of Jewish community buildings, but society as a whole is not anti-Semitic and it's not acceptable anymore. So then we've won, because anti-Semitism went from being an acceptable part of our culture and society to becoming something marginal and extremist and unacceptable. There's always going to be unacceptable views, but you want the unacceptable views to be unacceptable. Hamas is not a rogue terrorist group. Hamas is the elected government of Gaza. They hold the majority of the seats in the Palestinian Authority legislature. The majority of Palestinians, according to Colin Dunn just a few months ago in July 2023, had a favorable view of Hamas.
All right, we're gonna pause right there. I'm gonna come back. We're gonna set a break to finish this off.
I'm Paul Burnett, a board-certified doctor of holistic health. Over the years, I have helped countless people increase and maintain their natural energy production with Alfred Libby's Slow Dissolve Super B12, sold only by Trivita. I have never met anyone deficient in caffeine or sugar, but I have met many people deficient in energy-supporting vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 is one of the 8 B vitamins, and is an essential nutrient, meaning the body cannot make B12 on its own. You see, unlike other oral B12 supplements, Alfred Libby's Slow Dissolve Super B12 is fast-acting because the formula is scientifically developed to dissolve under the tongue, bypassing the digestive process, making it immediately available for use in the body. Alfred Libby's Slow Dissolve Super B12 is also formulated with other natural energy-supporting ingredients, such as folate, ginseng root, and other natural ingredients. Not only are the ingredients beneficial for energy, but they also support healthy cognition, mood, nerve function, and natural hemoglobin production. You deserve to live with greater energy and mental clarity. And now, like millions of others, you can with Alfred Libby's Slow Dissolve Super B12, sold only by your wellness partner, Trivita.
To order Alfred Libby's B12 for yourself, call 1-800-771-5584 or online at trivita.com. Order today and use promo code BROWN25 to receive 25% off your order. As a new customer, 100% of your order proceeds from your first order will go to support the Line of Fire radio broadcast. Call 1-800-771-5584, 1-800-771-5584, or online at trivita.com.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get on The Line of Fire by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, you have tuned in to the right broadcast today. Michael Brown with my friend, Orthodox Jewish Rabbi Pesach Malicki. Right before the break, you were sharing how Hamas is the elected government of the people of Gaza, and that even in recent polling, before this last attack, they polled favorably. They are unashamedly anti-Israel. They have called for the eradication of Israel, for the killing of Jews, not just in Israel, but at times around the world. And by the way, Rabbi Malicki, on Tuesday's broadcast, we actually played that video you sent me about Hamas. We played that for our viewers. So back to you as you continue your point.
Yeah, just to finish the previous point, I was contrasting. We have to contrast Hamas, which is, again, the elected government of the people of Gaza, whose viewpoint is held by the majority of Gazans by polling, and the extremists, besides the fact that spitting and slaughtering people are not equivalent, but those Jews who spit on those Christians, who, of course, that video went viral, when you know, the whole country was upset about it. The prime minister made a statement about it. We were all appalled. So the question is what you're experiencing the act of some marginal extremists, or is it actually the dominant culture that you're talking about? Now, is there still a lot of anti-Christian sentiment among traditional Jews? Of course there is. That's my job, Michael. That's what I'm busy with, and that's why I wrote that piece. And we are making – so I would ask any Christian who looks at that and says, wow, the Jews hate us, take a step back and ask yourself, what's the trajectory of the Jewish community as a whole in its relationship to Christianity?
Yeah.
Where is this headed? What's the big picture? And where does it all come from? But let's get back to to Hamas. I'm so happy. Thank you very much for sharing that video about Hamas. I think it's so important, and your listeners, I'm sure, are steadfast in being on the side of good and being in our camp. And it's so important to arm you, that you be armed as you step out into the world with the truth and know exactly what is happening here, because what Israel needs most in this war, what we need most from our friends around the world, and especially from our Christian friends in America, is to have our back in the media narrative war. There are so many people around the world that are painting Hamas as freedom fighters fighting for Palestinian independence. This Hamas, as I said in that video, Hamas has the same origins, the same beliefs, and the same goals as ISIS and Al-Qaeda, indistinguishable. They are part of the same. They come from the same parent company, as it were. That's who they are. Now, when we look at the broad picture, I said at the beginning of the broadcast that this is the most perilous time, the most dangerous time in Israel's history since the Yom Kippur War. And you look at it and say, well, why? It's just some terrorist group on your southern border. Yeah, it was a bad massacre. But we have to understand the situation is here. On the northern border, Gaza's on the southern border, but on our northern border, we have Hezbollah. Hezbollah has 200,000 rockets, missiles, pointed at Israel. Israel is a small country with the size of New Jersey, and it's been described by our security establishment as a country of 100 targets. If Hamas and Hezbollah would attack us from the north and south simultaneously, and there's already been some skirmishes in the north, they have been testing the waters, let's say. If we were to be fighting a war on the north and on the south, and especially if the Iranians then got involved, it would be, to say it's a dangerous time for Israel is an understatement.
Talk to us here in America. We've got listeners, viewers around the world, but the greatest majority would be in America right now. Speak to us plainly about your feelings about American policy, Iran, etc. Just go for it.
Yeah. Tomorrow Joe Biden is landing in Israel. It's been on all over the news that he's coming here to visit. And while many Israelis are very happy about this and think that Joe Biden is a great friend of Israel because of his speech last week, I'm I'm terrified about this visit. I think nothing good is going to come of it. I think it's going to cause problems for Israel. Let me explain why. In the last 20 years, the quietest time for terrorism, the time when the least amount of Israelis and Jews and tourists in Israel were killed by terrorism, was the Trump administration. And it was the direct result of not only the Trump administration policy, but of laws that were passed during that time. In March 2018, there was a law signed by Donald Trump called the Taylor Force Act. Taylor Force was a U.S. citizen. He was an Army veteran. He was murdered by Arab terrorists when visiting Israel in 2016. So they named this law after him. And it's a law that stipulates that the U.S. must withhold all economic aid to the Palestinians so long as the Palestinian Authority continues in what they call, in what is often called the pay for slay program. Now, yep. The Palestinian Authority pays the families of terrorists who murdered Israelis or even murdered tourists. And Taylor Force was a tourist. He was an American serviceman. He had served tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was here visiting Israel. So he was a Christian. I've met his parents. And stipends were being paid to his murderers as well. So the Taylor Force Act prevents the U.S. from giving aid, and Donald Trump enforced the Taylor Force Act. He signed it into law, and he enforced it. And immediately upon that enforcement, lo and behold, terrorism dropped down significantly. So much so that in the period 2014 to 2018, an average of 20 people were murdered by terrorists per year in Israel. Remember how small our country is, okay? An average of 20 terrorist murders per year. That went down. The lowest of those years from 2014 to 18 was 2018. That was the first year of the Taylor Force Act enforcement. And then in 2019, there were only 11 terrorist murders. And in 2020, there were only 3. Basically, terrorism had ceased. There was no incentive for it. And immediately upon taking office, the Biden administration announced that they were going to try to repair their relationship with the Palestinian Authority. They immediately started violating the Taylor Force Act. Now, let's remember, the Taylor Force Act is not a Trump policy. It is a law passed by both houses and signed by the president. And the Biden administration started violating it, and they still violate it to this day. They initially sent $75 million to the Palestinian Authority as a sign of goodwill in March 2021. And terrorism has been rising ever since in Israel. Put that together with the fact that the Biden administration has not only – to say they're coddling the Iranians is going too easy on them. They have basically waived – they haven't officially waived them, but they've turned a blind eye. They've waived sanctions on Iran, allowing Iran to sell its oil, enriching Iran to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. Everyone's focusing on the $6 billion that was – sorry – that was recently unfrozen by the administration. Many of your viewers and listeners will be aware of that, that a few weeks ago, the Biden administration unfroze $6 billion in Iranian assets. But they've enriched them far more than that $6 billion by their policies of basically lifting the sanctions on Iran's oil sales, which has enriched them to the tune of probably $60, $70 billion. By enriching Iran, by violating the Taylor Force Act, by President Biden snubbing Bibi Netanyahu when he was in Washington a few weeks ago, every signal and every policy of the Biden administration in the Middle East has had the effect of emboldening Israel's enemies and letting them know that America doesn't necessarily have Israel's back, because they're doing things that they know that Israel's opposed to. They know that the negotiations with the Iranian regime to re-enter the disastrous Iran nuclear deal that Donald Trump pulled us out of, the Obama nuclear deal, and the Biden administration has been working hard to get back into that deal with Iran. Israel has said from the beginning that this harms their security, and yet they proceed. This is not how an ally behaves. So for Joe Biden to now turn around after this attack and speak about being the steadfast friend of Israel. Okay, go ahead and enforce the Taylor Force Act. Go ahead and refreeze the $6 billion. He's not doing any of that. Not only that, in Joe Biden's speech the other day that everyone was lauding him for, he never once mentioned Iran, who we all know is behind the attacks. So from my perspective, American involvement in this, and by the way, as I'm saying, as an Israeli, I'm opposed to the U.S. sending financial aid to Israel for this. I don't think that we should be for that. Israel's not a poor country. We're not fighting the Russians. We have what we need. Israel doesn't need money or weapons right now. What Israel needs is the courage and the free hand to do what we need to do to defeat this ISIS, Al-Qaeda-style evil that is on our borders. That's what we need. We need the world to not pressure us into an early ceasefire. By the United States sending us money and getting involved in other ways, if that means that they also have leverage in our decisions, nothing good can come from that. So I, for one, am not looking forward to Joe Biden's visit. I think it is a perilous time for us, and I think we need to pray that the Biden administration does not have an impact on the decision-making of the Israeli establishment, because there's a great fear in this country that the Americans are going to push the Israelis to try to move to an early ceasefire. Let me just end with a request and a call to action, and that is to be engaged. Listen, this is the time. This is the time we've been talking about. When you open up your Bible and you read that there will be a time in the future when the nation of Israel has returned to the land, and then you see in Ezekiel and in Zechariah and in all the other books, you see that there's going to be wars in the land. And in Zechariah chapter 2, Zechariah speaks about how the nations will come alongside the people of Israel and fight alongside us. Listen, I don't know
now,
which
friends,
war
now is the time
this
to
is
pray.
The time.
Now
this
is the time to pray.
Another program powered by the Truth Network.